This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and we're here with another of our virtual events today. And this evening, we have a special treat for you. Our good friend Stephen Hunter is back with a new book, Basil's War. And we were just talking about it. We have a dwindling supply of autographed copies left. So I'll put a link in the comments field if you'd like to snag one of these before they're gone. And also, our good friend Jack Carr is here with us today. And he also has a very dwindling supply of his new book, The Devil's Hand. They come with these cool little cards as well. So I'll put that in the comments field as well. And as usual, I'll be monitoring the Facebook comments. So if you have questions for Steve or Jack, go ahead and put them in the comments field and I will emerge from the darkness in about 30 minutes or so to ask some of your questions. So Barbara, I'm gonna hand it over to you.
Thank you, Patrick. What a treat this is. What a great way to start the weekend. So Basil's War, Jack can deal with the question of how we pronounce this in just a moment, is a work dear to my heart, and embedded in it somewhere, there it is. On page 92, which Jack and talked to Stephen about, is Operation Citadel, which is in fact where this all started. So anyway, this is a book I have been hoping for several years. And this is Mr. Hunter writing, as I keep saying, this is Mr. Hunter writing as Ian Fleming, rather than the author of the Bob Lee Spiker books. And Steve, after I said that, I was really interested to read an interview with you that you have let loose your British voice in this book, or your version of a British voice, but the one that's inside you. So that'll be a fun thing for you guys to talk about. So Jack Carr, who is, let's see, on his, which James Reese book now? This is number four?
Well, on number five right now, but four is
working on number four, the Devil's Hand. And we have a movie to come. So that's all very exciting. Is going to be your host. So I am going to turn this over to Jack with the freedom to interrupt whenever I feel like it.
That's right. Awesome. Barbara, thank you so much. Stephen, great to see you. Thank you. This is so much fun. I always love to, when we get to link up, much better in person because we can go to dinner afterward and share some drinks. But
we can have a bottle of bourbon between us instead of a screen and a keyboard.
I know, I was ahead of you. So last three times I've done this, Barbara has held up wine and I've been good with water. And though this time I ran out at the last second because someone sent me this bottle. So I think it's pretty nice.
I'm holding up my beverage of choice right here.
There you go. That's much wiser.
So, I want to say one thing to the folks. Can I say something? Jack sent me a wonderful gift. He sent me a pistol case. And I just can't wait to open it and see whether it would be more appropriate for a 45 government model or a Python. So I'm going to open it.
All right.
What the hell is this? I can't get a gun in there. What is this thing? I can't make heads or tails out. Look, it's got a car. Oh, I get it. Now, this is my way of saying thanks to Jack, who is in the middle of a phenomenal ride, and it's so good and decent of him to take time out and join my little tea party with Barbara and Basil, and I'm just eternally grateful. He is one of America's true gentlemen. Here's to Jack.
Indeed.
Now, shoot, go ahead.
That is too nice. Thank you. My goodness, you guys are too kind.
It's been our pleasure to launch all four of Jack's books, but more fun than that, as much fun as that, Jack from time to time appears at the Poison Pen in other roles. He's been down to meet Clive Cussler, and on one memorable evening, he actually joined us to meet Stephen Hunter, and I think it was Mark, wasn't it?
Yep. Yeah. We
have Mark Rainey and Stephen Hunter and Jack Carr are all in one room. Lord, it was a family.
Was great. Such a good time. And Stephen, so I had a call yesterday from the publisher at Atria, and she wanted to congratulate me on audiobook hitting number one and everything. And then I'd sent her one of these cases as well, and she called it a briefcase. She has no idea that it's a gun case. And I didn't have the heart really to tell her because she was so excited about things. I didn't want to derail the conversation. She would probably be horrified to know that she actually has a gun case in her possession, although it obviously contains a book and not a pistol, but that's, you know, that's how these things go in New York. But so yeah, let's talk, first off, let's talk about pronunciation. Basil or Basil, and it's Basil.
Basil, let's call him Basil.
Let's call him Basil. So absolutely love it. So then this one, very kind. Thank you for signing it. Sincerely appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So much fun to read. And especially reading it with those British accents in my mind as I was reading the dialogue. Because your dialogue is always so great, no matter what you do. But in this one, I got to add the British accent to it. And I know that was a part of that you enjoyed, I think, when I read it.
Oh, absolutely.
So was that, is that what made you want to change or want to morph this from 2015, I think, into this, is to get to play around with a little more of that dialogue?
It was essentially, I mean, I do love writing in that voice. I wait for the Brits to tell me all the things I've gotten wrong, but so far they're quiet. And it won't be published over there until January, I think. And then they'll probably start yelling at me. But I do love that voice. And it's comes not from Harvard, not from Cambridge, not from Oxford, but from MGM. Because as you know, I'm a movie guy. I wasted much of my life in the movies. And in the 50s, when I was impressionable, I loved George Sanders. I loved all. I loved Alec Guinness. I loved Jack Hawkins. I love Albert Finney. I love those mellifluous, dry, that sort of dry, clever, biting, funny wit. And I just, I wished in my heart I had it in me to speak like that. Of course, I still sound like a cop from Chicago. But when I have time, that is when I'm running dialogue and I can stop the flow for 30 seconds and figure out something, I seem to be able to do much better. And you're so right. It was pleasure more than anything. It was just self-indulgent pleasure. And it was just great fun every damn second of it.
Oh, it's so great to hear. I could tell by reading it that you're having fun, especially with that dialogue. And for Basil in particular, he has some great lines in here. I mean, so clever, the whole thing. I mean, it's just fantastic. Love the dialogue. I mean, everybody has some great lines, but he in particular, of course, being the protagonist, he has some great ones. So there's some gems in here. So it's worth picking up for a ton of reasons, but that that in particular, reading that dialogue is just it's just beautiful. So I just thoroughly enjoyed all of that. In that, so did you have to do any research into the dialect, or did you just go on and enjoy growing up? And
a memory thing. I had to concentrate and actually remember my past, which is harder and harder these days, and remember the movies I'd seen. And you know what? You'll find this is so true, and you found it's true. A lot of it has to do with getting the rhythm. And if you can find the rhythm, it just sort of carries you along and stuff pops out of your subconscious that you had no idea you knew, and it suddenly presents itself. And so basically what I was doing was trying to catch up with my subconscious. And I'd always, like, the end of the day, two or three of them would have, you know, gotten away on me, and I'd be really angry, and hopefully I hoped they would come back the next day. But it was just, I was as surprised when they showed up on the screen as I hope readers are when they see them on the page.
Oh no, it's fantastic. And then of course we have some cameos there, more than cameos, by Vivian Leigh, and of course Winston Churchill, and that's fantastic. And I couldn't figure out who this Larry character was for a little bit. It took me a little while. But then I got it. Then I got it. that was fantastic. Like, who's this Larry guy? And then I went, then I got it. But yeah, I love all those things. I love when you send me researching, or you get me thinking about something, and you do that with all your novels. That's, I've always enjoyed that from the very beginning when I first discovered you 30 years ago, plus years ago now, I think.
Yeah.
But those little things, those little one lines in there that you sneak in, I think you sneak them past editors sometimes too. And it sends you off and on some of, what does he mean by this? Well, that's a, oh, is that an Easter egg for the future? Or is that just something fun that he's playing around with? Why is that in here? And I love that. It's fantastic. Thank you so much. I try to do that every now and again myself. You know, I try to steal that one from you. But yeah, you
gotta be 98 years old to do it well, like I am, Jack. And that you'll see when you reach 98, how easy it becomes.
I'll start weaving in some things from like from my childhood, like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone, and people will be like, "Who is he talking about? What is he?"
It's so it's kind of depressing, but it's always funny.
One of the great things about Basil's War is that Stephen, who won the 2003 Pulitzer Prize for film criticism, is able to bring some of his movie thing, because Jack's already told us about it. And you know, it is interesting to look back and realize the roles that a lot of actors and actresses, maybe we're only supposed to use one noun today, maybe we're just supposed to say actor for all genders, played in the war. They had a lot of, you know, some of them actually fought. Was it Jimmy Stewart, I think, actually was, and some of
he
them
was
did.
A very brave bomber pilot. He flew B-24 Liberators, which is a tough airplane to fly. He was on the Polizzi raid. He was a very gifted, very brave man. I think he might have been the biggest hero of the stars, but many of them, not like today, I might add, but forgive my bitterness, but many of them did indeed fight in the war and gave up these glamour jobs and these glorious lives and ended up in foxholes or airplanes. Guys that you, Eddie Albert, who was always sort of an avuncular guy, I think he won the Navy Cross, and it may have been Iwo, it may have been Taro, and it wasn't Taro, it was a late island, and he was a commander of an LST, and he took this big boat in close and beached it because he wanted to bring suppressive fire on a certain position that was killing a lot of Marines. And, you know, I mean, he never spoke about it. Those guys didn't talk. James Ernest was another one, was at Anzio, for God's sake. And he said he was the biggest value to the guys in his platoon because he was so tall, they'd give him their cigarettes to carry when they forded streams. So that way, I mean, that was him being modest. He didn't talk about all the heavy metal that came his way, but there were just many, many of them. And I'm going on too long here, but at one point I contemplated a book that would pay homage to all those guys because they really do reserve, it's just forgotten now and it's so wrong and it's forgotten, but so many of them did indeed do lots of stuff. And almost everyone who was British in the movies in the late 40s and the 50s was a commando or an RAF pilot or some dangerous job. You know, they weren't doing PR. They were out there where the bullets fly and the flak is real.
But some of them did PR. And in fact, that I won't go on and on about who in the book, but obviously at least one character in the book is in fact destined to go off and, you know, lift troop morale. So there were various roles that
she really did that, by the way. That's
time. Yeah, no, I was sure she did when you mentioned it. And then, you know, we're not even talking about like, you know, bands and so forth. I mean, you know, Glenn Miller, was it? No, which one went down in the channel? Was it Glenn Miller?
Yeah, Glenn Miller was shot.
It was Glenn Miller, you know, was, yeah. So, you know, there was a lot that people in the entertainment industry and its various aspects contributed to the war. So I could see that you had a lot of fun bringing that in. But Jack, can you hold up that little red book? Because that's really where this all started. And it would, you know, Stephen, why don't you, right, there it is. One of my favorite books of all time. And it's just a little tiny thing, a novella. So what prompted you to do that? Because Operation Citadel is embedded in Basil's War.
What it prompted me was an email from Otto Penzler, right. Your co-equal in Soho, Manhattan. And he offered me not much, but a nice, you know, no sneezing amount of money to take it and blow it out into a novel. And of course I said, yes, we won't go into the difficulties in the publishing world this caused me. And and the ramifications, some financial, some in terms of relationships, but it's now all straightened out. But the point is, I really wanted to do this when he suggested it. And it turns out maybe Jack has the same thing. I'm much better in a prescribed universe. If I've got places to go and I've got a fence around the pasture and I've got the characters established and I know where they're from and what happened to them, then I'm very happy tinkering and trying to get it all to fit together like the pieces of a clock, as opposed to, you know, starting out with something. If you look at the record, one of the problems that our Ernest Hemingway had was towards the end of his life, he would sit down to write and he had no idea where he was going. And he'd end up with, you know, with an 800 page novel that, excuse me, had no story to it. And then, you know, after he died, they sort of, the editors had to cobble that stuff together and add stuff and make it, put it in some kind of readable narrative structure. But I am happy with structure. You know, I want to be handcuffed when I'm writing. I could never write Dune or Lord of the Rings or anything that's fanciful and where there's no boundaries. I want to know what the uniforms wore, what guns they carried, what the terrain was like, what their backstories were. And in that little world, I'm very comfortable. Jack, you agreed? You had the same thing?
Love it. So I don't have another experience yet. So mine have been the characters that I started with are still the characters that I'm with today. So I haven't branched out into something else. And if I ever do, I think it will be in addition to probably me when the kids are out of the house, probably. I have a little more time, less interruptions. While readers are still interested in this storyline and the journey of James Reese, I'll stick with that structure and those characters and continuing them along their journey. But so I haven't had that sitting down yet with something new that I'm not sure readers want to even know about. So I haven't had that experience yet, but I'm sure at some point I'll delve in there.
I'm sure you will too, my friend.
And I love the dialogue. So what I realize is that when I start out, I write these characters down and I write their position next to them so I can remember how to spell it. So-and-so is the president, so-and-so is the director of the CIA. Right. But I don't get to know them until I start writing this dialogue. And I love writing the dialogue because that's where I find where I get to know the characters through their interactions.
Yes, exactly.
I love doing that part of it. But one thing I wanted to say also is that I hosted the premiere of season 2 of SEAL Team 3 years ago now, I think, in Los Angeles at the Los Angeles FW in Hollywood. And the walls had all those World War II veterans, pictures of them. And there were so many. And there's a theater there. There's a bar there. It's a beautiful place. But you're just overwhelmed by how many actors, how World War II affected everyone.
Yes, indeed. It was a big war.
And everybody was, even if you were staying home and you were recycling things or you were putting the blackout curtains up or whatever it might be, like you were doing war bonds, whatever you were, everyone was touched by that, a little different than today. But Lee Marvin, Charles Bronson, of course, come to mind as guys that were out there in the thick of it and then came back to obviously, you know, go off and have amazing careers in Hollywood. But I wrote an article on my blog not too long ago where I listed all these guys, everyone I could find anyway, that was an actor that had served in combat. And it was an extensive list, most all of it coming from World War II.
That's good.
Yeah. So,
well, that's
so.
Part of what, one of the things I believe it is what's called, I call the ritual of remembering. And I think we've gotten away from that. If you go to Russia, I know you've been there many times. You see T-34s and Soviet statues of guys with great coats and burp guns racing up there. You see them everywhere and they always have fresh flowers at them. And they have not forgotten the war. I mean, the war is still extremely vivid in their mind and it's passed on generation by generation. Obviously it cost them a great deal more than it cost us. But nevertheless, it's just, in comparison, it breaks my heart that there's so little remembering going on these days. And I think we owe the people who put us here a now and then of a ceremony of remembering.
Absolutely. I try to weave that into to stories and to interviews every chance I get, just talking about how people from the inception of this country up until today gave us these options and opportunities and these freedoms that we have. And yeah. So we owe them at the very least that when we're making decisions that are going to impact future generations, that we go back and we take that time, energy, and effort and put the requisite study into these issues that we're making snap decisions on, it seems like these days, based on tweets from certain people in different sectors of industry who have influence. So I just I try to keep get people back to the libraries, get people back to books, get in those books.
Exactly right. That's the point.
Spend some time in those books.
Barbara is, you know, that's what she does professionally, is gets, and that's the kind of book selling that we love, where the bookseller is involved with, knows her clientele, can book spot for them, and sort of makes it a community event as opposed to, you know, some giant warehouse where the books are spying out in the millions. I guess they sell a lot of books, but it's just not the same. I'm sorry, I'm an old goat. And I do love the real bookstore.
Well, thank you, Stephen. That's really kind of you to say that. Now, I don't mean to, you didn't quite answer my question. So can we go all the way back, to the Little Red Book?
I'm slippery as an eel, Barbara.
You are, and I didn't ask. Thank you, Joe, to start over. I wasn't totally clear, but this novella that you wrote also for Otto Penzler,
yes.
My question was, what was the inspiration for that? Because that novella is what has become Basil's War and an expanded version, but I don't know what the inspiration for the Citadel was.
I'll go through it quickly. It's very complicated, but I will do it in bullet points so that I'll leave out years and titles and things like that. My first novel was called The Master Sniper. It was published in 1980. The hero was an American OSS officer who'd been at Jedburgh, and he'd been wounded around D-Day when he parachuted in to blow up a bridge before the ground forces hit the beach. And that's why he limped through the whole book. 10 years later, maybe 15 years later, Otto asked me to write a short story. I don't do short stories. I don't like short stories. It's not my milieu. I had a joke for a long time. I was going to do a book called The Collected Short Stories of Stephen Hunter, all two of them. And, it's just not for me. So finally, what I decided to do was I went back to that paragraph of exposition, and I said, I will dramatize what happened on that night. It was June 8th, 1944, this Jed Team Casey landing behind the lines in Normandy. So I did that, and it was in that as a foil, I invented Basil St. Florian. And the point was, Leitz was very Midwestern. He was going to go to a medical school. He was a very orthodox thinker. He was very earnest. He was brave, but he wasn't exactly a ball of fire. And I wanted to play him off against someone who was sort of completely all over the map, who was funny and irrelevant and insouciant and languid and all those wonderful British things. So that's where I invented Basil. Are we calling him Basil or Basil? That's where, let's call him St. Florian. That's where, I didn't even know the name of my own hero. That's where I invented him. Another 5 years go by, and I get involved in a project of Otto's to write a novella. And I won't go through the ups and downs of it, but there were considerably both. And at one time I betrayed Otto. I said, Otto, I know I promised you, but I can't do it. I can't think of a damn thing. And he was really annoyed, as well he should be. But as soon as I hung up, I got this idea to do a story about Basil before 1944 in 1943. And that's where Basil became, so to speak, a star. And that was a 138-page novella. The central portion of this book is about Basil's adventures in France, but it was just limited to agent on the run in occupied territory. That's all it was. And then a few years after that, he calls again and he says, would you consider? And I said, yeah, I'll do it. But, you know, the project was to take that kernel and rewrite it and expand it and come up with new wrinkles. And as I said, that's the kind of thing I love to do. And that is the origin of this book today. So it really goes back to 1980. Now, I will also say that one of the things that made me so eager to do this was the enthusiasm of a certain bookseller. And that person was not Otto. That person, Barbara, was you. And I will never forget when I walked in selling another book, I think, I can't remember, they're all mixed up in my mind, but you were so lit up over Citadel. I just can't tell you how much that meant to me. And just filled me with energy and purpose and eagerness to get back to that. And that's really what Otto was feeding on. He didn't know what happened, but that's what he was feeding on. And that's what I was feeding on. And I should have actually dedicated it to you. Should also tell the folks that you read this book at a certain point and made very savvy editorial suggestions. Otto doesn't know that, but you did. And you helped improve the manuscript considerably. So this book is as much yours as it is. No, it's not. It's about 1%. No. But nevertheless,
let's not go there. Nevertheless. I have to tell you, when I got this, the first thing I did was read through it to see if you paid any attention to my editorial comments. I thought, you know, Stephen is, shall I kindly call him a maverick? Okay. So, you know, he is not led. He forges his own path. So I really was curious to see if you would follow those ideas. And I do think, to be honest, that it made it a better book. No pads to me, but I did think that when I reread it, that the structure of the book is much better.
Thank you so much. I do appreciate that.
Not at all. I loved it. I fell in love with your voice. I mean, you know, I'm not a gun girl. So, you know, while I love you, as you well know, my favorite of all your books is The 47 Samurai. I mean, I absolutely love that book with a passion. And it was, I think it was because of the sword. You know, I could relate to the sword way better than, I mean, Jack, you know, I just take Jack for granted that everything he does with guns is accurate, because I couldn't critique him, whatever, but the sword I could get. And I think one reason that I was so enchanted with The Citadel is that it's not a gun book. It's a wonderful voice. And, you know, Basil's War is too, but it's something I can follow much better. So I read the swaggers for the characters. I don't read them for the weapons.
That the only thing I could say is the next two books are going to so totally disappoint you.
Oh,
you're not even going to have me. You're not going to allow me west of the Mississippi. The books are so full of guns.
But you know what? You never leave the characters behind, Stephen, and that's okay. You know, I just sort of gloss over the guns and stick with the guys or the gals, because you really are a marvel at characters. So let me throw it back to Jack. Jack, do you agree with me that his characters are fabulous?
Absolutely. You know, the getting the guns right and making the weapons characters in and of themselves in a lot of cases is just an added benefit to the characters and to the story. So and to that voice, and most importantly to the heart. That's what when people talk to me about and ask me about novels that differentiate themselves from all the others, it's that thing that you can't put a finger on. It's that heart, and that Stephen's novels all have heart.
I know that's a great insight. And see, the thing is, as much as we love the guns and maybe sometimes even overdo them, the truth is that very few people buy it for the guns. I mean, the guns make us feel better than it makes them. What they buy us, and you know, there's no way we're ever going to compete in terms of action or battle scenes with the stuff that Hollywood is now doing. I mean, I can punch one button and I can be in the middle of the Battle of Kursk in a King Tiger facing 15 T-34s in immaculate detail. And so I can't compete with that. There's just no way. So we have to give them intrigue and character and story and twists and that sort of thing. So God help us, that's where our future lies. And I would like to think, I know you will, and I'd like to think I'll be able to continue in that direction.
Oh, absolutely. And can we talk about that future direction? Can we talk about what's coming out this summer and what's coming out next year? Is that something that's, is that top secret?
No, it's not at all top secret. And one of the reasons I liked all the talk about World War II is that I'm working on a book right now that I love. It's called The Bullet Garden. It'll be out in 23, I think, from our friend Emily. And it is actually set in, it's a World War II book. And for me, it's just been a great, fabulous wallow in World War II culture, popular culture, heroism, equipment. It's just so much. It's just so damn much fun. And before that, in January, I'm publishing a book called Targeted, which will is the last probably of the Bob Lee Swagger books. Don't give up on the Swagger, so there might be another Swagger somewhere along the line. The last of the Bob Lee Swagger books, and it's probably more political than I usually get. And there'll be some people who will not like it. That's fine. I don't care. I'm too old to care. Who gives a damn? But it was more than fun. It was like, it's like Pepto-Bismol, you know, it was a purgative. You know? It just got a lot of stuff out of my system. And that was, so I'm looking at that should be a very interesting month. I mean, it could be a total flop. We don't know, but it'll be an interesting month.
Oh, I'm so excited. Barbara, January 2022, let's get that on the calendar. So if we can, if COVID is done and Stephen is moving around for this next tour and I'm, you know, I want to be there for this one. So
I want you armed, by the way, just in case I need a bodyguard.
It's wonderful.
I'll be ready.
We're happy to know that our favorite restaurant has survived COVID. So we'll work it out. So, you know, one of the other things I thought was wonderful in Basil's War was the fun you had with bringing in Alan Turing and, you know, and the code. Because, I mean, a rogue librarian always works for me, you know, being one myself. But I, you know, there's been a lot of interest. I mean, here in Arizona, the Navajo Code Talkers are absolute legend.
I'm sure they are. They should be.
Absolutely. But I read something not long ago that said, I'm trying to remember if it's the Seminoles in Florida, do I have this right? That they also had some kind of a code and participated. They might have been jacked with the Navy. I know I just read that. But anyway, there's been a big interest in Bletchley, as you know, and Enigma and, you know, all the sort of codes of the war. And I thought you had a wonderful time in this book bringing in Professor Turing, who, I mean, your Turing is a little bit different than the Turing that I have seen depicted in other by other creators. So did you have a good time dealing with him and bringing all that in?
I think he's a great man.
Yeah, absolutely.
What happened to him is so sad. It's just, I mean, he won the damn war. What more do you want? And it's just sad and wrong what ultimately happened to him. So this was a way to get him in and sort of try, A, as a tribute, B, to show him as human. I tried to show him as a man with doubts and with a very strict moral sense. And it was really, it was more than anything, it was just like, I was like trying to, I mean, he helped me figure out a plot. There's no doubt about it. He was a total deus ex machina. He wasn't just there. And he had a part in the story, a very important part in the story. And his presence justified a lot of the action. But mainly, I just wanted to profess my admiration for this, really, for this brilliant guy.
He was too. Absolutely.
I love the clothes. I love the tweeds. Anytime I can describe a tweed suit, I'm all good with that.
I bought one before my first book tour. I have one. It has a shoulder shooting patch on it, though.
They're only good if they bagged out so much they cover your fingertips.
I'll have to go check that.
Believe me.
I thought I had to as I became an author. I thought it was a prerequisite. And speaking of that code, so I use a very similar code in The Devil's. That's why I have it. But I used, instead of words in books, I used letters in books. So a lot longer of a code. And I got it from an Army Special Forces sniper who was a part of Project Delta in Vietnam, which was kind of prerequisite to the Delta Force. The first commanding officer of Delta Force, Charlie Beckwith, actually commanded Project Delta in Vietnam.
Yes.
And they did the most audacious kind of missions of the war, going into Laos, that sort of thing. But that's where I got it from him back in the 90s. And so I incorporated it into this novel here at the end, into Devil's Hand. And so I'm curious, where did you first figure out that code or hear about that code?
Actually, the book code has been around for thousands of years. It's just you get information and it somehow in your brain, it breaks loose from its source and it surfaces and you don't know where it's from. You don't know if it's accurate. You don't know anything about it. I've actually used it before. I used it in my Spanish Civil War book back in, it was co-written with a Tyrannosaurus Rex. That's how old it is. Anyway, it was, it's just been around and I'm sort of horrified with it because I have such a short attention span. There's no way I could ever use it. You know, the hell with codes, I would just say, hey, get me out of this place. You know, I don't need any code stuff, but it's an espionage. If you're working espionage, our books aren't really pure espionage. And that's to me the best thing, that sort of meld of espionage and action. I mean, I keep waiting for John Le Carré to come up with just one freaking gunfight, and he never did. Great writer, no gunfights, very annoying. Anyway, it's just one of those things that's around. You know, I may have read it in some history book or something. I can't relate it to a precise thing other than my fear of it, knowing I could never master it.
because you have to find the exact edition and so it's actually a lot harder than I thought when this Army Special Forces sniper explained it to me in the 90s, right around the time I read Point of Impact, actually. He explained this code to me and I thought, oh, it sounds simple. And then I actually tried it out. And it was harder than I thought if you didn't already have the exact edition in hand, because you had to go around and find that exact edition. You had to look at the number to make sure that there weren't changes made to make sure it was a first edition, second edition, third edition, or a printing or whatever it was. Yeah. So you had to find the exact one is how I conceptualized it in my head. Now I realize it's harder than I thought. You have to actually, to make it work, you actually have to have the one, because things go out of print, as we all know. New editions come out. You could get the wrong code. You get the wrong whole, the whole thing could be wrong because you get the wrong code with the right title. So
and
there's a lot
the author decided, and the fourth edition, you know, I don't really think it was mauve. Let's make it umber. That totally screws up everything.
Exactly. All of a sudden it's a go instead of a no. It could be very problematic there. And then also, so I had another question about research for you. In this one, it seems like you knew a lot already. You didn't have to go deep into research because it seems like you already had it. And you got to get into the dialogue and have a great time with the story is how it seemed from the reader's perspective. But in Big Thrill Magazine, you said something and it stuck with me because this last book of mine, I had a stack of books, like it was 22 or 23 books that I had to research for this because it's bioweapons and a lot of academic research into this last novel. But you said, you have to be in control of the research. It cannot be in control of you. And I like that because this last novel, I felt like I was in control of it, but it was a lot. A lot. I didn't want to get it wrong because I had no touch points with bioweapons or anything else during my time in the military, like I do with weapons and things like that, with regular type weapons where I can just confirm things. This, I actually had to learn things, not just confirm them. So I spent a lot of time researching. So to be in control of the research, it cannot be in control of you. So in general, I guess for you, well, again, that's not in general. For this book, did you feel like you'd already done a lot of this research and you were?
Well, I mean, I was a World War II kid. I grew up in the 50s And the war was everywhere. It was everywhere. You know, you couldn't watch TV or read a magazine without the shadow, the memory, the vibration of the war. So, and I loved it. I mean, it was just so exciting and dramatic and tragic and funny and all. It was a universe. It was a whole universe. And so I did know a lot of stuff, but as Barbara knows, when you do these book signings, you inevitably meet someone who says, you know, I've got a great story to tell. And as soon as I finish the research, I'm going to write it. And I think to myself, he's dead. He's the walking dead. It ain't ever going to happen. You know, you can just let the research be a crutch and it just destroys you. There comes a time when you have to just write the damn book. You don't know it, make it up. You can always go back, you know, put a little asterisk in the margin, go back, look it up and make the change. But you just can't let it dominate your life and become an excuse for not working. I mean, what we really do is hit the keys. And if we're not hitting the keys, we're not putting the lettuce on the table for the grandchildren, or in your case, the children. You know, those damn kids like lettuce, in case you haven't noticed.
I've noticed. And my wife too. So yeah, I've definitely noticed.
Everybody likes lettuce, yeah.
I get it completely. That's what I tell people too, is that they ask me what books they should read when they're studying writing, or they want to write a book, what should they read? So what I say is, hey, it's going to be different for everyone, but at some point you have to sit down and do it. You can study something too much, and it's not just writing, it's anything you want to do in life. You can study that thing too much without actually doing it.
Well, that brings up an interesting point. I had one of the glamour jobs of American journalism. I was the movie critic of the Washington Post, and before that of the Baltimore Sun, two very fine newspapers. And so I would naturally be the guy to write the be-all, end-all novel about being a film critic on a newspaper. I wouldn't know where to begin. And the reason is I know too much. Stop any second in a newsroom and the backstories, the editorial policies, the cliques, every single thing comes into play, and you just can't freeze it in a way that's satisfactory to you. That's why Proust wrote, 22 volume novel based on The Smell of Cookies. But I know what he meant. I know exactly what he meant. Everything is connected to everything, which is in turn also connected to everything. And to do what we do, it's almost better to sort of understand that you just can't get it all in. There's got to be limits. Because if you don't, you know, if you start to describe someone's hair, that sentence could go on for, you know, 19,000 words, because there's so many factors and history and culture, all that involved, and why he's got a part on his side instead of down the middle. And you just have to, you know, I mean, I think it's one of our gifts is knowing what detail is resonant, salient, vibratory, meaningful, and what just puts people to sleep, you know. And I'm willing to take the chance with the gun stuff. I mean, I know, for example, one of my books had way too much gun stuff. Hear about it all the time.
Which one?
It was the third bullet. And for that one, I wanted to get everything in that was important to my idea. And they were not pleased, but I held out for that. And that's, you know, maybe it cost me, who knows, but I'm glad I did it.
Yeah, no, I love that. Well, obviously I love that part or those parts. I appreciate that sort of thing. So I do have another question though. Do you ever plan on reading this book?
Oh God, it's where I'm sitting. It's about 9 feet away. And I look at it and I get sort of nauseous with both guilt and anxiety. What if it's better? I just can't, I don't know how to deal with it. I just, yeah, that would be, that's very good. That's terrific.
Can you tell us what the book was so Patrick can type it in?
This is Death of a Thin-Skinned Animal by Patrick Alexander. And I'm going to look at the date here. Yeah, I don't have the exact, I'll look it up right here. 1976, first American edition, 1977. So this was a book that inspired an idea that Stephen had for a novel. And I have not read it either. I have it. And the same thing, it sits in the last house. It sat right across from me. I had most of my books behind me in the last house. Now they're in front of me. And this one in the last house was on a smaller bookshelf in front of me. And it still is today. And I have not read it yet either. But I am going to. I'll let you know how it is.
Well, I must say, this is an original thing. It's not as original as Proust, but it's something. Probably the only writer in history who wrote an entire novel based on another novel's jacket copy.
That's fantastic. That's why I love it so much. And then you not only do that, but then you credit the jacket cover.
Oh, yeah. Honesty is, it's a big mistake, believe me. I was afraid they'd sue me otherwise. So
you sold more of these than anybody else ever has, that's for sure.
Yeah, now let me just say that I do consider plotting my weak point. And I am always cobbling little bits here and there from other sources. I think one of the things that happens to us is we see something and we like it and it sinks into our subconscious. And as I say, it ultimately breaks contact with a source. And when it resurfaces, you think it's your idea. And so you use it, God, I'm so bright. And then years later, maybe weeks later, you realize that's where that came from. Maybe I'm not as great as I think I am. I mean, my book, what's it called again? The Day Before Midnight. That's Dr. Strangelove. And I didn't realize it when I wrote it. It was only like encountering it 3 years later and thinking about it that I realized that it was basically a memory play of Dr. Strangelove, just with the point of view shifted. You know, I did it from the point of view of the raiding commandos, rather from the point of view of the people in General Ripper's office. And I had fun. I mean, it was the first one of my books that was semi-big, and it was great fun, even if I stole the idea from Stanley Kubrick. He didn't seem to notice.
He didn't mind. That was the second book of yours I read after Point of Impact. That's where I went next. I actually read it on a plane to Alaska to spend about 75 days in the backcountry, which I then incorporated into my third novel, Savage Sun. So you've been with me the whole ride.
Well, that sounds far more interesting than any of my books. 75 days backcountry, good God. Here I have trouble getting from the sofa to the dining room table. You're talking 75 days wilderness?
It was a couple moons ago. It was a...
don't you think that everybody, every writer's work is informed in part by your life? I mean, Jack would not be writing what he's writing if he hadn't served as a Navy SEAL, even though his mother, a librarian, always insulted with the idea that he'd be a writer. And Stephen, you wouldn't write the same books if you hadn't been a film critic and, you know, lots of movies. But I don't see how you can write without being informed by what you've read as well. And in fact, we had a really interesting discussion a week ago with Laurie King and Lee Child, who edited the Mystery Writers of America handbook for mystery writers, which I might add is already sold out and being reprinted. So clearly a lot of people are interested in it. And the basic question that or comment that Lee makes is that, you know, to be a writer, you have to read. And so if you're a writer and you read, inevitably what you write will be informed by what you read in addition to the life you've led, right?
Yes, absolutely, totally.
Oh, correct. You know, so yeah, what if it's Kubrick or so what if it's, you know, First Blood?
Yeah. The only thing I could say is that it is a merge between what you've read and what you've seen, but you do, and you can't help but bring your own issues into it and make the people, I don't know, sometimes they're versions of yourself, sometimes they're versions of what you wish you were, or they're versions of what you're glad you're not. And particularly seminal, or what's the word, cardinal relations in your life, meaning your mother and your father. And my father happens to haunt my books, not in necessarily a good way, because he haunts my life, not in necessarily a good way. And you can't, you know, I mean, it just comes out. It's not something you plan to do. It's just part of the process as it gets out and it goes onto the page and there it is, you know. And sometimes you write the truth without even having thought of it before. It's just suddenly there, you know, your fingers typing have told the truth that you could never tell yourself. And that's just the way it is, you know. Don't you agree, Jack?
I do. I mean, we're all the accumulation, whether we're writers or not, no matter what we're doing, we're the accumulation of our experience in life, whether that's through reading, through popular culture, through experience, whatever that might be. That's a lot of what we are. And so, but we as authors, as writers, get to then put that onto a page. Then we get to take that experience, take those feelings and emotions and apply them to a fictional narrative. And a lot of times it just comes out because that's what we're drawing upon, whether it's conscious or subconscious. So I find it very therapeutic actually to do those things and to have those feelings and emotions come out, whether it's it's not the exact same format as it was in real life, or maybe it's something imagined because of something that I've read, but regardless, it's coming out in a way that's authentic to the reader and therapeutic to the author, particularly if it's from something real. And for me, that's Iraq and Afghanistan and other places like that. And I get to draw those in and completely fictional narrative, but it resonates. There's something you can't fake about that sort of thing. It resonates with readers, whether they know it or not.
That's a good point. Yeah.
They may
not even recognize it. And they're feeling, they're getting, you know, that's the glory of literature, that it can say things without saying things, and people can hear things without hearing them. And there's a communications going on that's not obvious, but is nevertheless emotionally significant, and you can almost put it into words, these sort of feelings you get, and there's no noun to describe. I feel his 7 degrees of melancholy and 4 degrees of sadness and 2 degrees of anger at his father when it emerged in Basic Training. You know, there's no way you can put that into words, right. And yet, if you can get that somehow under the text of the book, into what's called professionally the subtext of the book, then that's the way I believe you communicate most effectively with people.
Oh, that's right.
You guys raise a really interesting question about, you know, why is it that some people really can only write one book? Why is there only, Salinger really wrote only one significant book, or we have, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird or something. And I often wonder, you know, why is it that some people can produce just one book, but they either don't have anything else to draw on, or they're paralyzed by who knows? Whereas other people, like you two guys, are born storytellers. I mean, you know, you're going to write all the way to the grave, both of you, because that's just who you are.
Now look at Stephen King. He'll have, after he dies, there'll be 38 more Stephen King books to be published. Anyway, I mean, you're describing two separate phenomena. The one book, if you have a huge success, that can be crippling. And I mean, Ralph Ellison is one example of that. Ross Lockwood is another example of that. The guy who wrote Mr. Roberts, I can't remember his name. He was an example of that. And the guy who wrote, what is it? Oh, Cold Mountain, maybe he still will have a comeback. But there are these books that become phenomenal successes, and it does destroy the writer. Sorry, that's just the way it goes, you know, and they can't get it. But the other thing is, what happens to writers when they can't write? Why can't they write? And I'll throw a little screwball theory here on you, is that it's all about concentration. And at a certain point in your life, to get to what we do, we have to get to a certain level of concentration. And I believe that concentration is depletionary. That is, you get a full tank every month. And if you use it shabbily, stupidly, if you squander it, it's not gonna be there for your work. So I save it for my work, and that's where it belongs. And I think the fact that I can get to that level of concentration, can't stay there long, but I can get there every day and get as much out of it as I can until I begin to get blurry and wobbly, and I can smell the martini beckoning me, calling me. Then it's time to quit. And you know, to me, what a failure to write is a failure to concentrate. And you just can't do it at 60%. You've got to be in the mid to high 90s to do it.
That is so interesting, because there was a really great article in the sports section today, I think of the Times or the Journal, about Phil Mickelson, who finally, after like two or three years of being off his game, shot a 64 and has taken the lead. And when they talked to him, he said it was all about concentration. Yeah. That, you know, his shots were still there and all, but he somehow or other was not really focusing, or, you know, he's just over 50. So, you know, is it age related, or is it just something going on in his life? He didn't lose the skill set, but he lost the ability to make the skill set produce. And I thought it was a very interesting discussion, but it's kind of what you're saying.
If Jack is a Navy SEAL sniper, he is a master of concentration, because that is incredibly tense, skilled, fine work. And to do it well, you've got to be way, way at the top of the concentration tree. Now, he'll be modest. Oh, Steve, you're just, you don't know anything about it. You're just blowing smoke. But I know
Jack,
that
Jack is a phenomenon. You only have to follow him on social media and so forth to be just blown away. I think one of the things Jack has going for him, aside from talent and personality and lovable and all the rest of it, is that he is physically unbelievably strong. He has to be, or he couldn't possibly maintain the schedule. I'm exhausted every day looking at you, Jack. I mean, it's just
I'm exhausted every day. It's a lot of this is just the act part of it. The what's fallen off the plate is the actual workout, the sleep, the nutrition, all those things fell to the bottom in order to prioritize the writing and everything else that goes along with that. But for anybody that's listening, that is writing or wants to write or that sort of thing, I got some great advice from reading The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield, who said that truckers don't get trucker's block. He said, dentists don't get dentist block. Yeah. You're a writer, you write. And so I really took that to heart. And that when I sit down, I'm like, this is what I do. If I was driving a truck, or if I was a dentist or a doctor, I wouldn't go in and say, I can't do the surgery today. I have I have doctor's block. I can't possibly do it. No, you go in, your patient is there. It's on the schedule. This is what you do. This is where you're a professional. And I'm a professional writer. And that's what I do. I was a professional sniper, professional operator before. That's in the past. What I do now is write. So that's kind of how I conceptualize it.
Yeah, but you're really sneaky, because you've somehow worked out a 32-hour day. I mean, no, in addition to all the other things you're doing, somehow magically you've created a 32-hour day. It's just like, oh.
Yeah, I'm going to have to take it back on that. I'm going to get back to 24 at some point, because it's a little bit exhausting.
I'm sure it is. Patrick, can we summon you up, Ariel, and tell us if you have any questions of your own?
Now, is Barbara, this going for another, 5 or 6 hours? I'm not sure.
Barbara, you're one to talk about a 32-hour workday.
Well, that's true. That's why I appreciate Jack. He and I are both in some extra universe most of the time.
You're cut from the same cloth, I'm afraid.
This helps. It's coffee in the morning and this stuff at night. You don't want to flip those two, though. That's the
very true. World without coffee to me is, I can't even contemplate a world without coffee.
That order up.
We have a question for Steve, which is, is there any movement on a Dirty White Boys movie or miniseries? Wouldn't we love to see that?
And the answer to that is, if so, it's news to me. No, I know that it's owned by, I think, Fox, and the fellows who did Game of Thrones were very interested in it, and it said they were going to do it, but people kept throwing money at them, and it has a way of influencing behavior. Imagine that. And so I haven't heard anything, you know, in years. My whole Hollywood thing is a total wreck. So I don't know what to say. I don't think so. Thanks for the interest. Please thank that person for their interest. That makes me happy.
Jack, why don't you say a word about your own Hollywood, because you have a really interesting movie coming up.
Yeah, so it's an 8-part series for Amazon. I was on the set last week, and then I'm trying to go out for each, because each episode has a different director. So I'm trying to go out to personally thank each director, just say hello, that sort of thing. But yeah, it's filming right now, 350 people on set. And it's a lot like a military operation, and that's the Kraft Food Services is there, and they're like Army logistics that's feeding everyone. And then you have the explosives guy who's doing that stuff, and you have the weapons guy, and the actors are handing their weapons and their night vision stuff, and it's getting checked off as being, you know, checked in and back in the inventory. You have the mobility guy, the transportation person on set who's in charge of the vehicles, just like we have that person that's in charge of mobility and navigation in the platoon. You have Antoine Fuqua, who did Shooter, based on Point of Impact, and he's like the commanding officer out there. And then Chris Pratt starring, he's like the platoon commander right here, and they're both of those guys are setting the tone for everybody else on set. So it's pretty cool. But what's interesting, and Stephen, you might find this interesting too, is that I'm in that it's called Video Village. So I'm there with the executive producers, and we're watching, and we're seeing things blow up, and people on the with the wires getting pulled back when that happens, and it's all very interesting to me because I've my first experience with it. But then we have the key grip or someone come up and say, hey, I want to talk about Land Cruisers, want to talk about guns, and say, hey, I love this. Hey, will you sign this for me? Or the person in charge of makeup comes by and says, hey, my son has just joined the Marine Corps. He's in boot camp right now. He's a huge fan. Would you mind signing something? And of course, I bring boxes of books. I drive out with my car packed full of books for everyone. And the executive producers look around. They're like, this is interesting. Like, we haven't really seen this before. Like, everybody that's working on this is wanted to be here and wanted to be a part of this. And they're fans. And usually you don't get the key grip wanting to talk guns on set with the author of a book of a movie he's working on, of which they've done hundreds. So it's a pretty interesting experience for me. And the other executive producers there are saying that it's kind of a different experience for them too, which is pretty cool to hear.
I'm glad it's going so well for you. I think it's wonderful. But do you have a date when it's likely to come out?
I'm sorry.
Sometime in 2022, so as close as I can find out right now. So I'm sure it depends on a few different things. But yeah, 2022 at some point.
So I have to tell you, Barbara, it's 9:02, and I do have a martini arriving at 9:15.
Got it. We're just sloping our way off. All right, Patrick, anything to wrap this up before we lose Stephen's short attention span?
I have a question for Steve, which is, do you have a couple of favorites when it comes to World War II novels?
Yes, I do. And it's funny, this book that I mentioned earlier is dedicated to the great novelists of World War II, because they illuminated my life. And then they basically built me. And two novels that immediately come to mind, one is The Young Lions by Irwin Shaw. And before he got spoiled, he was a very, very good narrative writer. And I just remember that book is a wonderful, wonderful book. And the second one, not quite so well known, is The Big War by a former combat Marine named Anton Meyer. And it's a magnificent book, based on the myth of Hector at Troy. And his hero, a sergeant, was Hector, who, you know, he knew he was gonna die, but he also knew he had a duty to do. And he loved his wife desperately and his kids and everything. But he also knew that, you know, it said Trojan Marine Corps on his sweatshirt. So he went and did what, you know, he was Semper Fi at the end. And that's a very, very well done book.
As a newsman, you know, just some of the great war correspondents era.
Good. Yeah. No, like, I will mention one right off the bat, because I'm stealing from this person. And it's Ernest Hemingway's wife, Martha Gellhorn, not Ernest Hemingway. Martha Gellhorn was a much better correspondent than Ernest Hemingway. She was much braver. Nothing daunted her. No one in the press corps landed at Normandy except for Martha Gellhorn, who got aboard a hospital ship and ended up on the beach tending to the wounded and writing pieces for Collier's magazine. But she was an exquisite writer. She was sort of, what you call her, Ernie Pyle for people with IQs over 100. You know, she was a very good, educated, classical writer, not an old time Cracker Barrel newsman, but a very sophisticated and passionate observer of the battle in Europe. She first war was Spain in 1936, and her last war was I think it was Honduras in 1985. I mean, the woman lived in wars for a 60-year time span. She was an incredible correspondent and braver, maybe not braver than Jack, but she sure as hell is braver than me, I'll tell you that.
I like A.J. Liebling a lot, too.
So, guys, thank you so much. It's been an absolute treat to start off our weekend with you. So, since I know a martini is calling you and my dog is calling me, probably time to say goodbye. It's such a treat to see you. And let's talk about January as we get closer to January. That would be wonderful to be able to get together.
That would be so much fun.
It really would be. So as Patrick will remind you, we have a dwindling supply of The Devil's Hand by Jack, the fourth James Reese book, and of Basil's War by Stephen, but possibly they are renewable resources. So don't despair. Go ahead and order and we'll tackle what comes next. Anyway, there'll be a podcast to the program and this video will live forever on our Facebook page. So do bring in other people who might enjoy our conversation. Have a wonderful weekend, guys. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Stephen. Take care. We'll talk soon.
Yeah, I always thank you. You're the man.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.